You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, where your Washington Nationals have just advanced.
So you have put your Baltimore Orioles gear in the closet, and you've taken out your Washington Nationals gear. Is that what's happening now?
No, I'm still an Orioles fan first and foremost, but it's good for the DMV, as we call it, to have something to cheer for. God knows it's not going to be the Washington Redskins. So it's nice to have something happening, a little excitement, a little energy here in your nation's capital.
Well,
rock the red.
You know, I had my birthday a couple weeks ago, and for the first time, we had our annual Aussie Rules Football Grand Final showing on the same weekend that the game actually happened. I never had done it. Usually I tend to wait and get lazy in organizing it. And it was one of the biggest blowouts in Aussie Rules history. It was a terrible game. It was like 120-30. It was insane. But the Richmond Tigers won their second trophy in 3 years. So people are talking dynasty in Australia right now.
I didn't know Richmond, Virginia had an Aussie Rules team.
No, Richmond is a Melbourne suburb. Most of the Aussie Rules teams are Melbourne based. And they beat Greater Western Sydney. Greater Western Sydney is an expansion team. It was their first appearance in the finals. But they were not ready for prime time, sad to say.
Do you know my friend Henry Olsen?
Not personally. I know who he is.
I think he's into this, too.
Really?
I think you guys could nerd out together big time. Between the polling numbers and the political surveys and the weird foreign sports that you guys like.
Now, you mentioned him on the show before as a guy who is sort of one of the more intellectual Trump-friendly conservatives. I don't know if he's quite a Trump loyalist.
Yeah.
But he was more defending of Trump than others. In conservative elite circles. Do you know where he is now?
No, I haven't seen him in a couple months. We need to get together. But the last time I just sort of saw him, he tweeted last night that he was going to be guest hosting a Breitbart radio show.
maybe he's not coming back into the Never Trump category at this point then. But we did have a Fox News poll yesterday.
Yes.
That had 51% of Americans say Trump should be impeached and removed. So it wasn't even like an impeachment inquiry question. It was straight up, get him out. And I think the don't impeach was 40%, if I remember correctly. There was a 4% of impeach but don't remove. You know, slap them on the wrist. And I think the Republican number for impeach or remove was like around 13%. I think there were higher numbers for people who were self-identified conservatives. I think there was more in the low 20s. So what does this tell you? Are there actual cracks happening on the conservative side of the ledger here?
I think there are. I think that, remember when Jeb Bush called him the chaos candidate?
Oh, yeah.
I think people liked the little chaos for a while. They wanted a little drama. It was exciting. Mm-hmm. But we've had a few years now of chaos and drama, and it doesn't stop. And I think people are exhausted, and I think they keep hoping he's going to settle things down. And instead, he keeps ratcheting things up. And I mean, the latest is the Kurds. Mm-hmm. And this thing could really spiral out of control. It's really hard for anybody who's a conservative or a Republican to defend it. It's essentially defending the indefensible. But it comes on the heels. Man, I mean, let's just go through the story. So you had Trump and Giuliani admit that they pressure coerced Ukraine to investigate Biden.
I hate to be defending of them, but okay. I'm sure they would not use the word pressure. They would say they asked Ukraine to investigate corruption, which just happens to be Joe Biden, Hunter Biden.
Right, and it happened to happen at a time when we had not given Ukraine the money that they need for defense.
But they vehemently argue that those things are unrelated.
Of course. Then we had the release of the so-called transcript, which I think seemed to confirm the way that I've framed the story.
Well, even I would say, I mean, the transcript is indisputable that Trump asked Ukraine to investigate a main political opponent. Like, right. That is just indisputable. And then I would argue that is sufficient for it to be a violation of the oath of office, even if you can't prove the quid pro quo or military aid element of the question.
Then we have these diplomatic texts. Then we have a story that Trump told China he'd look the other way on Hong Kong in exchange for, I think it was, cooperation on the trade war.
Right.
Then not only is there a report that Trump asked China to investigate Joe Biden, but Trump publicly comes out and asks China to investigate Joe Biden.
Right.
And then, of course, we have the old news, the Russia stuff, which I still think is legit. Certainly, he was willing to collude, whether he did or not. We have the fact that he paid off a porn star. And now we have the fact that he has thrown our allies, the Kurds, who were indispensable in defeating ISIS, has thrown them to the wolves and basically is allowing Turkey to crush them. And this isn't like, Bill, this isn't a week or two. This is a week or two. I mean, some of it, the porn star part is older, Russia's older, but like, it's really hard to say that that doesn't warrant impeachment and removal. And I think that is why even some Republicans are saying, look, I can't defend this.
Well, I just saw Adam Kinzinger on CNN, who was, you know, not criticizing Trump about Ukraine so much, but was very critical about what's going on in Turkey and the Kurds. I mean, Lindsey Graham's mind must be broken at this point. I mean, he's literally vehemently defending Trump on the Ukraine front while accusing him of violating the oath of office in his handling of Turkey and selling the Kurds out.
And this pokes a hole in the whole premise that Lindsey Graham had, ostensibly, which was, if I suck up to Trump, I will stay relevant and I can whisper in his ear, and that will impact public policy and maybe prevent Trump from doing stupid, crazy, horrible things. Like, I always thought that was a flawed rationale, sort of a post hoc kind of thing that sounded great because it also allowed Lindsey Graham to get reelected. So a manufactured, retrofitted excuse, but whatever, at least there was some element of plausibility to it, but that is gone. If you think that you can buddy up to Trump and that will actually help prevent him from doing something crazy, that's just been disproven.
So it seems like within Washington Republican circles, which are, you have a lot of national security conservatives in that community, this is very much a breaking point that you'd sell out the Kurds. I mean, it's not even like some sort of neoconservative adventure we're talking about here. These are the people who are actually fighting ISIS. This is just straight up counterterrorism, which support for fighting counterterrorism, support for that crosses party lines, ideological lines. I mean, obviously, there's some people on the fringes that just want everybody to come home, but most Americans across the board want to fight ISIS and not have ISIS commit terrorist attacks.
Well, there's so many elements to it too, right? There's the kind of capriciousness, like, why now? Why did Trump just wake up and decide to do it a couple days ago? Then there's the visual aspect. Like, we will have video and pictures of Kurds being slaughtered. That, from a political standpoint, from driving up a narrative, is more damaging than something that's like esoteric about the rule of law, right? Even though I think that the rule of law stuff is super important, and that using the prestige of the White House to coerce a foreign power to investigate your domestic political opponent, I think that's really, really horrible. But I don't know that the public will grasp that the way that they could grasp imagery. There's also the fact that this is a real disincentive for anybody else to work with us in the future. And there's also the fact that there could be weird things that happen. Like, for example, ISIS militants could be released or could escape during all of this, and there could be a refugee crisis in Europe, and there's all sorts of like externalities that come from this. And then there's Trump coming out and saying things like, oh, well, the Kurds didn't help us during the D-Day invasion or something.
Normandy,
so it's, this thing is This is a, and that is why, Bill, people laughed at me when I said, I'm not predicting it, I'm not betting on it, but there is a chance that we get to 20 Republicans who would vote for removal. This is why, because it's dynamic.
Now, having said all of that, and clearly you have a lot of consternation amongst national security conservatives in Washington. You know, there was a Twitter exchange, I think it was this morning, between Margaret Brennan at CBS and Tommy Vietor, who was the Obama administration. I think he's part of the Crooked Media team. I think it is the Pod Save the World podcast, if I remember correctly. She had argued, I guess they got sucked into an argument because she was drawing a parallel to Obama and Syria, which he disputed. But that's neither here nor there. They were both agreeing that people underappreciate how much in Trump's base, the Republican base, they like his message of ending endless wars and pulling out and bringing the troops home. So the argument that we're not staying in Syria doesn't necessarily resonate with the average Republican, even if it's upsetting, you know, the Washington Republicans. Do you think there is an argument there?
Yeah, but I think most of it is because the base has changed to fit Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. In other words, there are some cases where I think Trump was ahead of the curve in identifying where the base was. There are other examples where the base has actually changed. You know, the base, the things Donald Trump is saying today are basically what Michael Moore said in 2003. And the Republican base back then would have been outraged by those things. So I think, and this is a case where they've changed in order to fit Donald Trump. And
the question is, could they change back?
Yes,
based on events, if they're still with Trump and they still like the American first frame that he puts this in. I mean, you won't see 20 Republicans oust Trump for Pence unless they feel Republican voters have their back.
Yeah.
So if
and Bill, here's another important thing to keep in mind. When we do national polling, and as you noted, Fox News, 51% of Americans now, according to the Fox News poll, support impeachment and removal, which is important. What's more important than that, I would argue, is where they live. Okay? So if we're looking for 20 Republican senators, that means you need 20 states. So, you know, Texas has a lot of people living there. They still get two senators. But what about Ohio? What about Michigan? What about Utah? Right? So I think that's an important part. In other words, you don't need 100% of people wanting impeachment before it becomes the not only the right thing to do, but the smart political move for Republican senators.
Now we don't have the geographic breakdown, but in the Fox News crosstabs, it does say that 12% of Trump voters want him impeached and removed, 22% of conservatives, 28% of white evangelicals, and 38% of rural whites. So does that suggest that you could actually get this to be electoral college approved to impeach or remove?
So I think when you break down the kinds of people who might vote for removal, there are different categories, right? There are people who are liberated to a certain degree because they're not running for re-election. So someone like a Lamar Alexander would fit into that category. Then you have people who are liberated because they have a machine. So like Lisa Murkowski in Alaska was able to win a write-in campaign, which suggests to me that she is somewhat immune from the whims of her, you know, of Trump, of Trumpism. Then you have people who have a couple, like Mike Lee is somebody who is both a constitutional conservative who maybe just might do the right thing. And he's from Utah, just like Mitt Romney.
Right. I mean, Romney and Lee could work in tandem and be safe in Utah.
They would be safe in Utah. Then you get to people like Ben Sasse and Marco Rubio, who in the past have exhibited some principle but have lacked courage. They probably need momentum and a nudge. But then you have these other people who are up for re-election, right? So McSally in Arizona, Gardner in Colorado. Where do they go?
Susan Collins in Maine, and also I think Tillis in North Carolina is also
Tom Tillis.
Yeah.
So you got three or four, and they go where with what gets them reelected, and I assume that their default is to stick with their Republican president.
Well, I mean, I don't know off the top of my head the filing deadlines for primary challenges, but I think it is pretty plausible that we have a House impeachment vote before the end of the year and a trial in the early part of next year, and this is all said and done before the Iowa caucus happens. And I would imagine that would be before any primary filing deadline. So if they think it would be good for me in the general election to oppose Trump, that may not be good enough for the primary, and I got to worry about that first.
Right. So I think the key here is that public opinion matters greatly, and public opinion in the right places matters greatly.
So I don't know what else I have to say about impeachment. Well, I almost hesitate to even talk about this. It seems so inane to me. But this whole debate over where they have to have a process vote to have a formal inquiry, I'm sort of surprised it's even gotten this far, because you won't impeach without a vote anyway. There will be a vote.
Right.
You can't go forward without people being on record. So it strikes me as just a stall tactic by the Trump folks. And it's being entertained by the Democrats because they want to take away any kind of excuse to not comply with subpoenas. And I would imagine they could probably win that vote. They can get over 218 for formal inquiry if they feel is necessary. And maybe that's where we're going to come to at this point. But I highly doubt if once they have that vote, Trump's going to say, okay, here's, we'll come, we'll testify, here are all the papers. You know, they're right. Going to keep their roadblocks. And where I think this does matter is, I think Democrats have to proceed, as much as we've been talking about how the numbers are promising for impeachment and there's cracks on the Republican side and Trump's actions in Turkey are unsettling to a number of Republicans. With all, putting that aside, there are still people in the middle that get twitchy about impeachment, that it feels partisan, it feels like political games, and the Trump people are actively encouraging treating this as just another political football, everybody's playing politics here. And so that makes it very incumbent on Democrats to be extraordinarily careful how they characterize things, the language they use, the avenues of investigation to pursue. So I just heard in the Daily podcast, they followed around Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan to town halls, and one that was more of a Democratic town hall, one that was more of a Republican town hall. And she came up for an inquiry, and she was in the more conservative part of her district, and she referred to Trump wanting to dig up dirt on Biden. And that word triggered the conservatives in the room. And one woman who was trying to be sort of polite and complimentary, you know, I thought you were more of a blue dog Democrat. I sent you a letter about immigration. Your response to me was great. And now you're using a word like dirt, which is so obviously partisan and political. And then on the podcast, not to her directly as far as I know, but I mean, maybe it was to her directly, but she said to the podcast host, she was right. I need to be more careful about my language.
That seems a little pedantic or something to me.
But you know, people get focused on crazy stuff sometimes.
I bet you that woman didn't invent the idea that digging up dirt is crossing the line.
Well, but it parallels the whole Adam Schiff thing. That Adam Schiff was paraphrasing the transcript in a hearing, used the word dirt, and the Trump folks went ballistic. Right. He never said that.
Right. And Adam Schiff is not good at what he does. Let's be honest. I mean, I think Nancy Pelosi is, you know, arguably the best politician of a generation. But she's got Nadler and Schiff, and these guys I don't think are ready for prime time. And if Democrats blow it, then I would say I think they need to be really careful about Schiff. I will concede that.
Well, I don't think Schiff's a loose cannon. I don't think that's fair. I mean, I think obviously in retrospect he should not have characterized the way he did and gave Republicans an opportunity.
You have Donald Trump on the record, and you have to manufacture. This is like Edmund Morris stuff, Bill.
But the intent there was not to put words in his mouth. I think he was doing a paraphrase, and it got misinterpreted. I mean, should have been more careful. Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, Nadler and Schiff represent pretty blue areas of the country. I mean, granted, as is Pelosi, but Pelosi has much more of a mindset of, I got to protect my moderates. And, you know, people are operating off of gut instinct right now. They're not taking a breath. They're not pouring through the polling so much. And something like saying the word dirt, I mean, even someone like Alyssa Slotkin, who is in a swing district and is highly sensitive to her entire district, it didn't instinctually occur to her this word was going to cause me a problem.
No, you have to be careful. But I will say this. If you look at when Democrats a couple weeks ago announced, when Pelosi announced the impeachment inquiry, public opinion has gained for impeachment.
Yeah.
And I think that is evidence that that it was the right thing to do, the right move, not just morally the right thing to do, but also politically, and that once you begin the process, other things material, you know, it's dynamic and it creates other situations. It's kind of like when the first person comes out against Harvey Weinstein, it invites others to come out and basically tell their story too. And then maybe Weinstein react, you know, not to compare Donald Trump to Harvey, but, you know, I do think that there was a fear that impeachment would flounder and that Democrats would end up looking stupid and it would be a huge backlash. Remember Trump, there were stories, Donald Trump wants impeachment. Mm-hmm. They're playing right into his hands. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, it doesn't look like that right now, does it?
Well, and I think that's because, as you know, Pelosi's setting the right tone. Yeah. Pelosi's being very sober. She's not using personal invective. She's talking about fealty to the Constitution, upholding the rule of law. And my guess is that, you know, whatever mistake Schiff has made here, I mean, again, I don't think Schiff is someone who's blown a gasket. He is someone who I think is pretty loyal to Pelosi. My guess is Pelosi has sent the word out. You guys keep it together. Ocasio-Cortez, Tlaib, Oman, the rest of you, this is no time to be saying impeach the MF-er. And you haven't heard them. You have not heard them go off half-cocked in the past 2 weeks. Which is why I think there's been some conversations.
No, that's a very good point, Bill, because I tell you what, all it would take would be Tlaib or AOC, any of them, to say something crazy, and this narrative could very quickly change.
Yeah, I think Pelosi's keeping a tight rein. I mean, people might make mistakes. Some individual person might say something wrong, but the overall tone you're seeing for Democrats, I think, is pretty on point. And that's why, to get back to the reason why I bring up the whole process vote thing, that they may feel they have to do it just to say, look, we are crossing every T. We're doing this in the responsible way. And they can try to make us look political, and I'm sure with the Trump base, they're going to keep saying it's political. We have to go the extra mile to say that we're not doing this out of politics. And this is why I also think the timing might be very quick, because any kind of games with the timing, let's drag it out into the summer of 2020, you know that's going to get hammered for trying to meddle with the election when you're trying to say Trump's the one meddling with the election. Right. So I think they have to be extra careful. I think they want to be extra careful.
I wouldn't be surprised they have that vote. One of those rare cases where the right thing to do and the smart thing to do are the same. The smart political thing to do is to take this seriously and to not play politics with it. And look, I'm a conservative. I mean, this goes without saying, Bill. This is obvious, right? But I'm a conservative person. I am pro-life, free markets, low taxes, strong national defense. Have, you know, poster of Ronald Reagan hanging above my bed, I wish. And I think this is, like, if Trump doesn't deserve impeachment and removal, then nothing anybody could ever do would deserve impeachment and removal.
Let's shift to the Democrats.
Okay.
In 2020. So we have a number of events this past week. We had Bernie Sanders recovering from a heart attack and gradually getting back into the swing of things. We have Joe Biden ratcheting up his rhetoric on impeachment, saying Trump deserves to be impeached. And now going after the Times for, I always see the headline. I assume it was because of that Peter Schweitzer op-ed that recycled the Hunter Biden stuff. And that follows him trying to get the media, the TV shows to not book Giuliani anymore. And you have this flap with Elizabeth Warren and her story about her dismissal as a young teacher, when she was pregnant, and her response to that. Do you have an interest in any of these three? Do you want to talk about first?
I think all of them are legit stories, which in this environment become subplots at best. To me, the big story, which isn't like gossip, but is just an overarching theme, is Joe Biden, and that the fact that Donald Trump, this whole impeachment thing started because Donald Trump wanted to get rid of Joe Biden, whom he rightly views as his toughest opponent. And Democrats seem poised to give Donald Trump exactly what he wants. They seem to be ready to ditch Biden. And in fairness, Biden is not exactly running a vigorous campaign right now. Despite coming out recently, it's a little bit late. And I think Elizabeth Warren having some stumbles, and it speaks to the question of authenticity and honesty that the Pocahontas story was also about. It still seems like the Democratic Party wants Elizabeth Warren is where the energy and excitement is.
Well, look, yeah, you know, we've said in the past shows, and nothing has changed in this regard. You know, Warren's on the rise, and there certainly is a lot of energy and enthusiasm for her. And Biden has been stagnant; he hasn't collapsed, but he's stagnant, and his support is less animated. But they are tied in the Real Clear Politics average. Now you have. You could qualitatively say Warren still has the edge nationally. I think there are 5 or 6 polls in the average right now, and she's up in 4 or 5 of them, and Biden's only up in one, although he's up by a lot in that one, and she's up by a little in the others. So it's still roughly speaking a tie. And she's made some inroads with moderates and with African Americans, but he's still doesn't do that badly with white college educated and liberals. So it's not but you know, his support is still skewed towards older moderates and African Americans. Her support is still skewed towards white college educated liberals. So we can't assume that because Warren has gone up 7-8 points. I've got the exact number right now over the last 3 weeks in the average. That upward trajectory has no ceiling. There are still people out there, I mean, just anecdotally, what I can see on social media, who still worry very much that Warren is not a general election material. And there are people that worry that Biden doesn't have his fastball right now, and isn't meeting this moment with Trump's attacks in a way that makes them feel comfortable. So there is some nervousness, I think, with both of them. And if both of them had a serious problem where, you know, I mean, Warren has yet to really go through the ringer. You know, this pregnancy thing perhaps has been contained relatively quickly for now. She had a very forceful.
It's overshadowed by big news.
Overshadowed big news. She had a very forceful pushback. Her people, you know, stuck with her very, very vehemently. No other Democrat candidate is bringing it up, which would supercharge the incident, and that's not probably not going to happen.
Tulsi. Wait till Tulsi gets on stage.
We will see. Now I'm losing my point is, she hasn't had a real sustained period of bad press, since February, when, she had to apologize for citing herself as a Native American on her Texas bar card. That's a pretty long run of good press. And I have a hard time believing any candidate's gonna go from October to February without a run of bad press. And just the fact that this pregnancy thing came about because a writer for Jacobin, on the socialist left, accused her of dishonesty on Twitter, and that got picked up by conservative journalists, which percolate up through the Heritage blog, the Daily Wire, and then the Free Beacon did its own story, and then that's when it got into CBS News and elsewhere.
Is Heritage – so there's the Daily Signal. Is that Ben Shapiro's and Daily Wire's?
Maybe that's what I thought. Forgive me if I'm conflating Heritage and Shapiro. But I thought it was Heritage's operation.
I think Heritage is the Daily Signal and Ben Shapiro is the Daily Wire. But I could be wrong.
Forgive me if I made an error. But so it basically, there was this tag team between the socialist left and the conservatives to make this a thing where it actually gets into mainstream media. I don't think that dynamic has ceased because Warren has, for now, beat this one back. There are Bernie people that do not like Warren and think she is getting in the way of a socialist rebirth. And there are conservatives who are not saying, let's keep chill about Warren so Biden goes down in flames and we'll pick apart Warren in the general. They're happy to go after her right now. So I just think something's going to happen. There's going to be some period of time where she's really going to get put through the ringer. And I'm not saying that means she'll be over. I'm saying she'll have to prove herself in that moment.
But I wasn't just joking. I mean, I was joking about Tulsi, but it could happen. I mean,
sure
if there's
happen.
One person... If there's one person who could take it to her, it could be. Well, and Tulsi endorsed Bernie last time, right?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I mean, who knows? I mean, wild things could happen in a debate. You never know who's going to be the wild card who says something out of the blue. It's Chris Dodd that took apart Hillary Clinton in the October 2007 debate about driver's licenses.
Chris Christie destroyed Marco Rubio.
Right, you know, something that happens. My point is, it is possible that Biden, you know, has a bigger collapse and that Warren has a collapse. And then you have a total free-for-all where that vote goes. So there's still a lot of uncertainty here. So I would not assume that all the energy is with Warren and all the energy is with having a populist left candidate. There is still a moderate faction. There is still an electability faction. I mean, you know, Warren may be convincing more folks, hey, I am more electable. I am better on the stump than Joe Biden is and Bernie Sanders is. And that is a better, factor in determining who's most electable here. I mean, she doesn't obviously put in those exact words, but I think that is a lot of the subtext here. And she could possibly get the nomination on that basis. But my point is, there are still electability voters out there. Probably the majority of Democrats are still electability voters. And if Warren does something to make them think, oh, maybe you're not electable, that rise is not going to continue.
Yeah.
And now Biden, and I think as much as we can say, or people are saying, you know, Biden's handling this and kind of a, you know, he's trying to finesse this too much. He's not really taking it to Trump, and Trump's taking it to him, and he looks kind of weak. One, he has a lot of bites of this apple. I don't think that is a definitive conclusion that he has missed the moment here. If he hasn't seized the moment yet, I don't think he's missed the moment. And it is very likely that we're going to be talking about Biden for months. I mean, he might even get subpoenaed. There is a question whether the House minority will have subpoena power in an impeachment inquiry. I mean, it's one of the arguments for the Republicans having a formal impeachment inquiry vote is to press the case that they deserve subpoena power because that's what happened in past impeachment processes. And if they have subpoena power, they can subpoena Joe, they can subpoena Hunter, all sorts of people. Now, does that work in their favor? You know, I mean, one of Hillary's best moments in the primary in 2016 when she got hauled in to talk about Benghazi and held her own for 10 hours. Then you might say, oh no, Joe Biden can do 10 hours the way Hillary Clinton can, but it's an opportunity to show your stuff and maybe he rises to the moment. I don't know. But Biden's not going to be a non-factor because his name is intrinsic to this whole discussion. And so he has more and more continued opportunities to show he knows how to handle it. And maybe over time you say, you know what? Biden didn't, you know, overdo it up front, but having a measured above the fray, I want to keep us to be a unified America tone. Maybe that works him over the long haul. I can't quite say at this point.
That's fair. We're just going to have to see how it plays out.
I feel like we'll see what happens. It's so infected our discourse because of Trump. I try so hard not to say that in any conversation. Now, what do you think about Bernie trying to recover from the heart attack? Do you think, you know, there's no coming back?
He just had one of his children passed away.
His daughter-in-law.
His daughter-in-law. Okay.
Yeah, it was Levi Sanders' wife, who was only in her 40s.
Horrible. So tough times for Bernie. I don't know. I mean, I hate to say wait and see, but will he be in the debate Tuesday night?
Yes, he said he would.
Will be, right? Yes. So that's going to be the test. If Bernie is robust, then that's maybe it's sort of a boost to him actually. Yeah. You know.
No, I think it's performance-based. If he shows energy and vigor.
Right.
I mean, it's like any health problem. You know, as long as you look good. Yeah. I mean, as much as Hillary got knocked down for the whole pneumonia thing, once she got back on the trail and she looked fine. And we weren't talking about that. We're talking about other things, but not that by election day. Now, I do wonder if Bernie dials it back a notch, is that good? Because sometimes he can overdo it. You know, sometimes he got a little too old man on the lawn.
Yeah.
And maybe if it makes him, and you know, he's under a lot of pressure to argue he is a better leftist choice than Warren. And sometimes that may compel him to, you know, be a little too angry. Yeah. I mean, if there's anyone in this race who's not smiling enough, it's Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth Warren smiles a fair amount. Kamala Harris smiles a fair amount. Bernie's the angriest one in this whole bunch. He could use perhaps a chance to show he could be more stately in this process.
Definitely. Bernie's not the type to talk about this, but you know, you could imagine a scenario where somebody, you think about like, you know, Reagan coming back from the assassination attempt, TR, you know, as a Churchill said, nothing more exhilarating than being shot at with no effect.
Teddy Roosevelt being shot in the general election.
And still gave his speech.
Right.
So you can imagine a scenario where Bernie comes back and talks about like, what he learned from this. And I don't think Bernie is that introspective or, there's a potential opportunity.
I wouldn't expect soul searching. I can see him tied into single payer healthcare.
Oh yeah.
I had wonderful doctors. You know, I've been through a horrible situation, but I'm doing in great shape, and I'm thankful that the care that I had, I want to make sure everybody else has that care.
Yeah.
I could very much see him doing that.
Maybe he will. Jamie Kilstein, who's a friend of mine and a comedian, had this skit imagining what it would be like being in the hospital room with Bernie while Bernie watches the debate on TV and narrates it and like yells at the TV. But apparently he'll be there, so.
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about?
Mm-mm. No. And we wouldn't, Bill, you can't improve upon perfection. This is the perfect call.
I wonder though, Matt, you don't seem as down today as past weeks. Is the possibility that Trump might actually get impeached and that Republicans might actually oust him from office? Is that putting a little spring in your step?
I think it has.
Are you getting excited for President Pence?
We'll see. Pence, it'd be nice. I don't know if Pence is going to make it. No, but I will say, just to the larger point, I do feel, I don't know if you've noticed, I've stepped it up a little bit on Twitter. I mean, I've been a Trump critic this whole time.
You've always been case by case.
Yeah, and I've tried to be measured, but I feel like... I feel like this is a time.
Time for choosing.
Yeah, as Reagan might say. No, I think it's a. I think it's a defining moment, and there is no yeah, but. I mean, clearly Trump needs to go, and having it be so clear has kind of liberated me a little bit, and I think part of. You know, if I've seemed down these last several years, it's partly been because, you know, a conservative commentator wants to fight for their side, you know, and I haven't been able to do that because of all these Trump and all that. So I've been very torn, and it's nice to not be torn. And so I think that's what it is.
All right. Well, welcome to the resistance. I'll get you your squad t-shirt.
Well, did I move from never Trumper to resistance? Have I been upgraded or downgraded? Am I in the concierge level now?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a never Trump waiting room.
Yes.
To see, you know, are you going to be a never Trump squad hater? And in that case, then you can stay on the New York Times op-ed page and you don't get your squad t-shirt and full access to the club and all its amenities.
All right. Well, for now, I guess I'm on board. So we'll see. We'll have to wait and see how it plays out, Bill.
All right. Well, so next week, the debate, next American debate is on Tuesday. So we'll talk after the debate.
Yeah, let's try to do, if possible, we can do like a postmortem of that. That would be great.
What do you got to plug?
Well, the podcast is kicking ass. We just had Stephen Hayes on, who, along with Jonah Goldberg, has launched a new website called The Dispatch. So check out my conversation with Steve Hayes. We didn't really get into politics too much. Mostly we talked about the business. How do you get people to read your website, podcasts, newsletters, come to your events, conferences, the whole model of journalism and how to monetize it and all that. We talked a lot about that. Let's see. Who else did I have on? Who else have I had on this week, Bill? Oh, Jeremy Peters of the New York Times, who covers the conservative movement, had a great conversation with him about journalism and about what that's like. So check that out as well. And coming soon, I haven't released this one yet, but I had a good talk with our friend David Petrugia about the 1919 Chicago Black Sox scandal, which, of course, we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of that. Had a fascinating discussion. If you're into baseball, stay tuned for that. Matt Lewis in the news.
David Petrugia is coming to Northampton.
What?
To speak at the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Library and Museum, where I am vice president of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Library and Museum Standing Committee. Our annual meeting is Saturday, November 2nd, and there will be a public address by David Petrugia talking about his book, 1920, The Year of the Six Presidents.
Which is coming up on the 100-year anniversary.
That's right. So he will be speaking at the library and museum Saturday, November 2nd, 2 p.m. So make your book your tickets. We have the train that comes from D.C. Now we have more routes. Amtrak has juiced the schedule. Easier to get to Northampton by train now on the Vermonter.
In preparation for the Petrugia.
That's right. So I'll be giving some introductory remarks there as well. So it's going to be a good time to have by all.
He's a great guy and just so knowledgeable. Yeah, and the book
He's a great storyteller.
It'll be good. So,
also to plug, I did the Unprecedented podcast this week. I was the guest on that show, hosted by John Aravosis and Cliff Schechter. And we talked a lot about impeachment and divides in the Democratic Party and bipartisanship and Ellen and George W. Bush and all that stuff. So we had a solid 90-minute chat. So if you got a long car ride coming up, you know, download it into your phone.
And in a different world, we would have just had a 45-minute conversation about Ellen. You know, that's a worthy topic. That's true. We didn't get to it. Listen to the Unprecedented podcast.
That's right. So I'll talk to you next week, good sir.
See you guys in the DMZ.
Take care.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.